crowd loud. Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Julian Assange is free at last. In the first segment of the Project Censored Show today, we welcome independent journalist and author Kevin Gostola. His book, Guilty of Journalism, The Political Case Against Julian Assange, is a definitive account of that case. We'll talk to Kevin Gostola about the case, about the recent plea deal, and about what it means for press freedom worldwide. Later in the program, we're joined by Project Censored's Kate Horgan, Reagan Haney, and Shaley Voidel. We'll discuss an article they did for the special double issue of the Progressive magazine on media literacy, their piece, Navigating the Digital Democracy. We'll talk about how social media has the power to influence voters during an election year. Stay tuned for a new episode of the Project Censored Show. Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Today on the program in this first segment, we are excited to bring back Kevin Gostola, independent reporter at The Dissenter, also author of Guilty of Journalism, The Political Case Against Julian Assange. And we are delighted to have Kevin on the program today to celebrate the fact that Julian Assange, believe it or not, is a free man. That doesn't mean that there weren't costs and consequences. That doesn't mean that the future of journalism is preserved. We have to be ever vigilant. But Kevin Gostola has been on this case since its inception. Kevin has been our go-to expert on this. And of course, we're not alone in this. The late, great Daniel Ellsberg said of Kevin and his work that he is a rare journalist who understands the abominable threat that the case against Assange poses to press freedom. Ellsberg said he relied on Kevin's indispensable reporting not only to stay informed about Assange, but to follow developments in the wider war on whistleblowers. And Kevin Gostola, welcome back to the Project Censored Show for a rare occasion when the two of us can have something good to say about the Julian Assange case, and that's that it's come to an end, but not without costs and consequences, not without him apparently pleading guilty to journalism. Kevin Gostola, welcome back to the program.
It's good to be with you. And let me take a moment to say what I've said on multiple shows, which is it's unfortunate that Daniel Ellsberg did not live for this moment so he could share in the cheer. There's so many people who have contacted Julian Assange. And I do want to say up top that the mood is jubilant on the part of the Assange camp, that this is a victory for them. And in fact, Jeremy Corbyn, who we know as a leading politician in the UK and had contacted Julian Assange and congratulated him on the victory. And Julian Assange said, no, it's everyone's victory. We all share in this. Stella Assange, his lawyers, everyone, they've made clear that this was a global movement that created space for plea deal negotiations.
Which is absolutely important, very important to remember. And of course, Kevin, you can give us more of a background too to remind folks of this long and twisted, torturous case in many ways. But also, you know, let's talk about the right now. Let's talk about what also just happened. And I know that off air, you and I were talking. We had a clip that we want to share of folks of Julian Assange, basically saying that he's in a way disagreeing, of course, with the interpretation, but also simultaneously noting that he is in fact guilty of journalism. Is that an accurate assessment?
Yeah, and as the author of the book Guilty of Journalism, I would like to tell you I had no idea he would sit in a U.S. court one day and say, when he was asked to describe his quote-unquote crime, that he would say basically he was guilty of journalism. And so let's play the clip right here.
Right. So let's play the clip of Assange in the courtroom. Here we go.
At this time, I'm asking you to explain to me, what is it that you did that will constitute the crime charge?
Working as a journalist, I encouraged my source to provide information that was said to be classified in order to publish that information. I believe that the First Amendment protected that activity, but I accept that, as written, it's a violation of the Espionage Act statute.
So you had certain belief, but you understand what the law actually says as well.
I believe the First Amendment and the Espionage Act are in contradiction with each other, but I accept that that it would be difficult to win such a case in given all the circumstances.
And so there's the voice of Julian Assange in court, essentially noting that he sees as incongruous or incongruent the Espionage Act and the First Amendment, but was not prepared to move forward to argue the case given the circumstances. Kevin Gostola.
That's something that, beyond Julian Assange's freedom, we all have to grapple with. Anybody who cares about freedom of expression, the standards that the United States tries to set globally, what is being said there, accepted by a U.S. judge and supported by the U.S. prosecutor who's in the room, is that the Espionage Act and the First Amendment are basically incompatible. Essentially, under the Espionage Act, there are no First Amendment rights. So once you violate it, you do not get the claim that the First Amendment protects you from prosecution. So the First Amendment says one thing about what's allowed in the publication of news, and then the Espionage Act says another. And there's no settled law, and we live in this lawless state at this point until some court actually settles this matter. The sad part is the only way to settle this matter is to have a case where a journalist is punished for journalism. It won't be Julian Assange, but there will be a case in the future, because the Justice Department will try this again.
Kevin Gostola, the punishment was in the process. That's even come out now. Assange agreed to plead guilty to one count, is that right, under the Espionage Act, which was basically 5 years time served when he got to Australia. But he is also a free person after many, many years of being tortured, being imprisoned, being surveilled, harassed, and even the subject of a potential CIA assassination campaign. Kevin Gostola.
Julian Assange was released on bail from Belmarsh Prison, which was known as, and still is known as, Britain's Guantanamo, after enduring harsh confinement conditions in which his physical and mental health deteriorated significantly. He hopped on a charter flight, and the Australian High Commissioner, it's the most senior diplomat in Australia, flew with him. They had a layover in Bangkok, and then they flew onward to a U.S. territory. I kind of think it's a colony, but they went to North Mariana Islands in the Pacific Ocean, and they went into this small courtroom and had this proceeding very fast, lightning fast. This typically does unfold over like 2 or 3 months. They did the guilty plea and the sentencing all in about an hour and a half. And then he went onward to Australia, where he could rejoin his family, finally. And in this hearing, what we heard was that the U.S. could not identify a single victim of these leaks. Oftentimes, the government, and they did this in Chelsea Manning's case, I believe, they'll seek restitution for individuals who were harmed by the crime. They did not name a single person. That tells you that there are zero, and it confirms zero, and it's a message to the news media that they should stop talking about how WikiLeaks has blood on its hands and repeating U.S. propaganda, because even the U.S. government itself could not go before a judge and prove harm.
Kevin Gostola, can you say a thing or two about the establishment press in the U.S. and their very touch-and-go, tepid kind of relationship with the case of Assange? I mean, going back to Manning, going back to their twisted, self-contradictory statements even about their support of press freedom, but this information wasn't gotten properly, yet they went and published. The New York Times, major newspapers, won awards for using WikiLeaks information while they were simultaneously throwing Assange and WikiLeaks under the bus.
To me, the best way to illustrate the twisted relationship is how even today, the New York Times will say and claim that Julian Assange was a source and not a partner in working on these documents that came to WikiLeaks from Chelsea Manning. And that was because they wanted to try and insulate themselves from being prosecuted by the U.S. government, or else they wanted to act like they were better and different than Julian Assange. But it is a distinction without a difference. The U.S. Justice Department does not see any difference between Julian Assange and a New York Times editor or reporter who works on previously classified documents from the U.S. government and publishes them. So it's on them to recognize that this precedent is severe for the future of journalism, and it's going to be up to us to reckon with it. While Julian Assange is healing, we're going to have to reform the Espionage Act, get a public interest defense for journalists, or pass a reporter's shield law that could exist in this country to protect journalists from subpoenas that might offer some kind of protection from or deterrence from the Justice Department trying to have their way with media organizations. I appreciate the bittersweetness of this. You know, on one hand, we can celebrate that this is a massive defeat, in my view, for the CIA, for the FBI, for the Justice Department's National Security Division, which I think would have been perfectly comfortable if, through the punishment by process, Julian Assange wound up being pronounced dead at some point in Belmarsh prison. They didn't get that. Instead, he walked out free and boarded an airplane and came home to Australia. On the other hand, Reporters Without Borders, the Committee to Protect Journalists, Freedom of the Press Foundation, various civil liberties organizations, all of us are looking at this going, what happens next? And that's really disturbing.
Well, what does happen next? I mean, let's talk a little bit about some of what's been going on. And I'm speaking with you on Thursday, June 27. The program will air next week across the U.S., Kevin Gastola. It's also, I believe I learned recently that the U.S. was charging Assange for chartering the plane that took him back to Australia.
So what it sounds like is they had the Australia government pay for the flight. And then the Australia government said, we'll get Julian Assange to pay us for the charter flight. I don't know why they're putting an ally in that position to begin with. I would like to just be an anti-imperialist for a moment and say the U.S. arrested and charged Julian. They kept him in prison. They're the ones that lost confidence in their case. They no longer wanted to be as aggressive as they had been and bring him to the U.S. for trial. They got tired. They didn't want to continue to put up with this fight because Julian Assange did not give up and was actually in a winning position because there was an appeal hearing coming where they were going to argue over the First Amendment and say that if Julian Assange came to the U.S. for a trial, he would be prejudiced due to his nationality since non-U.S. citizens have no First Amendment rights. That was something the High Court of Justice was taking seriously. It brought the U.S. government back to the negotiating table for a plea deal. And so they should be paying for the flight. They should be putting Julian Assange on the plane, bringing him to a U.S. courtroom, and then securing their guilty plea. But I'll tell you, in addition to that, one of the things that stunned me is just picking up on little details. I looked at the press release from the Justice Department that announced this plea deal with Julian Assange and how they had secured a guilty plea to the conspiracy charge under the Espionage Act. And I was stunned because there are no statements from any high-ranking official celebrating the outcome. Nothing from Attorney General Merrick Garland, nothing from the U.S. Attorney in the Eastern District of Virginia, nothing from anyone who worked on this case. And it's also very sloppy and wordy. It's a closing argument, basically, like the kind that you would give before you get a verdict from the jury, and not a statement of victory. So even today, the announcement of the plea deal, they're still trying to persuade the world that their actions weren't corrupt.
Pretty amazing developments. Chief among them, of course, is that Julian Assange has been released from Belmarsh prison, pled guilty to one charge under the Espionage Act, but is a free person in Australia. We're speaking with author and independent journalist Kevin Gastola. His book, Guilty of Journalism, The Political Case Against Julian Assange. We'll continue our conversation about Assange, WikiLeaks, and press freedom on the Project Censored Show after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment, we're talking about the case of Julian Assange. He walked free just the other day. I am now talking with independent journalist and author Kevin Gostola. His book, Guilty of Journalism, the Political Case Against Julian Assange. No stranger to the Project Censored audience, Kevin and I have been having repeat segments on this program going back years now, talking about whistleblowers, particularly WikiLeaks, the case of Julian Assange. Here we are, Kevin Gostola, talking about something that you and I didn't know that we'd be talking about, and certainly not so soon in terms of what we were staring down this summer. Another appeals hearing coming up, and we and many of us free press advocates in the U.S. were girding for extradition. We were preparing for even worse developments, even given how bad things were for Julian Assange. But in an interesting and rare turn of events, he is now a free person. Kevin Gostola, it's an election year in the United States. Trump is the one that helped really ramp up charges under the Espionage Act of Assange. Biden, of course, and the Democrats, you know, going back to Biden-Obama, they prosecuted more whistleblowers than any other presidents combined. And look, as much as you and I might like to think that the Assange case is so important that it's a burning issue for many Americans, the reality is that it really wasn't. Many Americans don't even recall much of who he was, and most of what Americans knew seemed to be based on the propaganda and misinformation that kept floating around from our own press, distorting the case, which is, again, why your book is just fundamental to understanding the case. If anybody wants to understand the backstory of what happened in this case and what we were up against in terms of press freedoms, not just the case against Assange, but the press itself, your book is a primer on this. Your book is a one-stop shop. But Kevin, how much of this do you think was that this is an election year? I'm leaning towards not much of it.
I don't think that the upcoming election mattered too much. I could see officials in the Biden White House or the wider administration being uncomfortable with the idea of putting a journalist on trial or a publisher on trial. However, Biden called Julian Assange a high-tech terrorist when he was vice president. And Donald Trump, his only use for WikiLeaks was when he could reference emails from Hillary Clinton's campaign and attack his opponent. But he doesn't have anything from WikiLeaks to attack Joe Biden this round. He didn't in 2020. And he had no interest in seeing it through. He apparently told Judge Andrew Napolitano that he was going to pardon Edward Snowden and Julian Assange in the final days of his presidency before Joe Biden was inaugurated. That would have been January 2021. And then he let people like GOP Senator Marco Rubio and Mitch McConnell get to him and frighten the bejesus out of him that they were going to vote for impeachment. So then he would have to deal with that. And both Assange and Snowden did not get their pardons. So I don't believe electoral politics had anything to do with this. It is the appeal hearing. And it's also the pressure of a close ally, Australia, that ultimately gets this done. Kevin Rudd is a former prime minister for Australia, and he traveled to Washington, D.C. not long ago. This is according to Jen Robinson, who was Julian Assange's Australia attorney. And he was there aggressively demanding that the Biden White House end this case.
So that's extraordinary. The Australian government ended up playing a pretty key role. I know that there was criticism over the years of various parties not seeming to do enough. But a lot of this stuff, too, Kevin Gostola, happens behind closed doors. One thing that we do know is that the many committed folks, journalists, people who are First Amendment enthusiasts in reality, not just abstractly, people that support press freedoms, we at Project Censored have been unwavering in our support for Assange going all the way back to Chelsea Manning days, and you've been covering these issues since then. Kevin Gostola, what do you think is next for these discussions around the Assange case? Obviously, there needs to be a lot of personal healing, and he needs time to be with family and reintegrate. He's suffered immensely over the last 5 years. Justin Belmarsh let alone prior to that. What might we see coming in the next month, month or two over summer? And of course, our press freedom groups, you know, really going to rally around this and maybe use some of this momentum. There are other journalists and other people and other publishers around the world, less high profile than Assange, that need help and support and need a bigger platform.
Looking ahead, part of the plea deal was the U.S. government making a commitment, and they put this in writing, that there will be no charges brought against Julian Assange going forward for any publications before this plea deal. So that's gold. And it means he can't get in trouble for the Vault 7 materials from the CIA. And it means he also can't get in trouble for any of the campaign emails, the DNC or the Clinton campaign emails that were published, if they wanted to say that was a crime. So what I think people should be focused on is ensuring everyone knows about this history. I'm pleased to say that I wrote a book that will now be a history book. It's not something I need to go around waving and warning people of what's to come. It's the past. And so people will have to educate themselves on this history and then find a way to use it in a manner that can help prevent a future Assange case, a similar Assange case type case, because we need Espionage Act reform. We need a reporter's shield law. And I'll just conclude here. I just want to quickly roll call and thank the people who gave me a platform regularly to discuss this Assange case. Breakthrough News, Scott Horton's radio show, Status Coup with Jordan Cheriton, Project Censored. And these shows were spaces that I could turn to. There were a lot of progressive media shows that didn't invite me or welcome me, but these were shows that cared about Assange. Support independent media like these shows.
Thanks, Kevin Gastola. That's very important to note because it wasn't just the establishment press that had a bizarre, hypocritical stance on a lot with what was happening with Assange. There were even some press freedom groups, and there were even progressive outlets that just couldn't be bothered with Assange because they believed the misinformation, they believed the smear campaigns against him, and they wanted to distance themselves from it. But, you know, I think that a lot of us that supported the First Amendment, that supported press freedom, and that supported Julian Assange, I think that we've been vindicated here by this recent outcome. And it came at a high cost and a high price. And I want people to know that when we sit here and celebrate the fact that Julian Assange has been freed from Belmarsh prison and is in Australia, been back in his home country, that came at a very steep price. And Kevin, you write about that in your book, Guilty of Journalism. You write about the many things that Assange endured. And then I wanted to end by reminding our listeners about a few really, really important cases and things that we know about because of Julian Assange. Kevin Gastola.
Julian Assange was in some form of arbitrary detention for the last 14 years. He spent around 7 years in, nearly 7 years in Ecuador's London embassy. And then he was in Belmarsh prison for 5 years. And he was in solitary confinement conditions for like 23 hours a day. He's had sunlight deprivation, sensory deprivation, essentially. This has done incredible damage to Julian Assange. But then you look at some of the examples of what WikiLeaks brought to us. I'll just focus on one incredible example that people will understand right now as the United States protects the Israeli government from accountability. You find in the WikiLeaks cables examples of the Bush administration and the Obama administration interfering in European courts so that CIA agents and U.S. soldiers are not prosecuted for war crimes. You find cover-ups, blocking of investigations into the deaths of people who are journalists or individuals who were tortured. And so that's something we should take away, is that WikiLeaks was about accountability and justice. I don't know if WikiLeaks will be functioning again now that Julian Assange is free, if we'll be seeing more leaks, leaks on the war on Gaza, leaks on the war in Ukraine. I would love to see those. But whatever might happen, you know, there were these shows like yours that invited me to discuss this case. If I could quickly there's a couple I left out. So Lee Camp has had me on. I need to give credit. And Katie Halper and some other people out there were good. at inviting me on their shows. And I just want people who have listened to me give these updates to know other colleagues of ours that did care about giving space to this regularly. There's a lot of progressive media shows that did not follow this case or care what was happening to Julian Assange.
And that's the part that is very unfortunate, but I think it's right to call attention to the sources, to the spaces that really were dedicated to this issue, including people at Mint Press News, Manar Adlai and Alan McLeod, and Loki, obviously to Consortium News, Jalaria, of course, your colleague, John Kuriakow, and others. There's a long list of people that supported Assange, but to me, it was mystifying to see how many were afraid of the case or didn't get the case. Well, it's good for us, Kevin, and it's good for Julian Assange that he is now a free person. Let's just say it. The U.S. government didn't come out looking great in this case, and I think they took a defeat. They really didn't win this case. I know that a lot of damage is done, but it is also true, Kevin Gostola, that the U.S. government didn't win this case.
Yeah, I'll just quickly say, I don't think there's any winners other than the fact that Julian Assange wins because he still has his life. He's not dead. But beyond that, there are no winners. And so perhaps that's why they were able to reach a plea deal, because in the end, they both had a shared interest of finding a way out. You had basically Julian Assange is going to fight for press freedom. United States government is going to fight for the national security agencies that want revenge. And in the end, they basically looked and said, for either of us to get those things, it's going to probably be 4 or 5 years from now before we reach that point.
Except they're playing with people's lives. They're playing with major press freedom principles, things that we really, really live by. Kevin Gostola, it's always wonderful to have you on the program for your updates and your great reporting. And in this case, it was actually great to have you on to celebrate the freedom of Julian Assange. And I know of few other folks that were as invested in this case as you. And so I know that you're really delighted. I know that he is now free. And of course, we'll still be following the case and following what's going on with Assange. The chilling effect, Kevin Gostola, is still out there. The chilling effect against people who are leakers and whistleblowers. Even though Assange has now walked free, he paid a heavy price.
Yeah, this chilling effect is real of the U.S. government trying to define who is and is not a journalist. Julian Assange is a journalist. I open my book. Those are the first words. Julian Assange is a journalist. I hear from the civil liberties crowd that it doesn't matter because the First Amendment just protects acts of journalism. But to me, conceding that the U.S. government has some kind of a point that he is not a journalist, that he exists in some gray area, opened us up to this case in the first place, because we were then pulled into this area where they could claim that their prosecution under the Espionage Act somehow doesn't threaten the First Amendment because Julian Assange is not a journalist. And so if we had just all agreed that he was a journalist from the beginning, we would have been in a stronger position to fight for Julian Assange. Anyways, we're here, and I'm very pleased and proud that this comes to an end, that the saga of 14 years, it ends a chapter in my life. But we're talking about Julian Assange, who is the important person here, and it brings an important chapter of his life to an end. And now, as the judge said to him, who I was actually astounded, wished him a happy birthday. You don't get that from U.S. judges usually, but she also said, I hope peace is restored for you. And so that's the great thing here, that peace has been restored for Julian Assange, and he can have whatever life he would like after this. It begins with recovery. It begins with taking care of his own health, and then we'll see what comes from that. I look forward to whatever Julian Assange still has to offer this world.
That's the voice of Kevin Gostola at thedissenter.org, author of Guilty of Journalism, The Political Case Against Julian Assange. Kevin Gostola, always wonderful to have you on, and a pleasure to celebrate Julian Assange's freedom with you today. Thanks for all of your important work. Up next on the Project Censored show, I will be joined by three folks that work with us at Project Censored. I'll be joined by Kate Horgan, Reagan Haney, and Shaylee Voidel. We'll be talking about a recent article they co-authored for The Progressive magazine. We had the pleasure of taking over The Progressive as a guest editor for their special summer edition on media literacy in the election. And these three folks wrote a stellar piece on navigating the digital democracy. Social media has the power to influence voters. We'll find out more about how after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment of the program, we welcome three authors from Project Censored that have recently contributed to the summer issue of the Progressive magazine. Last week, we had on Norman Stockwell, Andy Lee Roth, Misha Garakoulis. We talked a lot about the special contents here. It's really something that such a prominent political and historical magazine like The Progressive took on the issue of media literacy in the summer of this election year. As you know, folks that listen to this program, we are always harping about critical media literacy education and what we can do to be more informed, to be more meaningfully civically engaged. And the three people that I have joining me right now penned a stellar piece on navigating the digital democracy. We are joined by Kate Horgan, website design and media assistant at Project Censored, and a member of the Media Revolution Collective, co-authoring The Media and Me, a guide to critical media literacy for young people. We are also joined by Reagan Haney, Project Censored social media manager. Her work has been featured in the Project State of the Free Press Top 25 Censored News Stories list and in the Junk Food News chapters. And last but certainly not least, we're joined by Shaylee Voidel again. Welcome back to the program. Shaylee is the digital and print editor at Project Censored, and her writing has been featured in Truthout, The Progressive, Ms. Magazine, and more. Kate, Reagan, Shaylee, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, happy to be here.
It's a delight to have the three of you on, and in addition to having the pleasure of working with you all at the Project on critical media literacy issues, social media issues, so many different things, you three collaborated for a wonderful piece, a very important piece, called Navigating the Digital Democracy. Social media has power to influence voters. And of course, you can learn more at progressive.org. But let's start with you, Kate Horgan. Maybe you can give us a little overview of what this article is about and what some of the main concepts are.
I think first and foremost, we were really just honored and excited to be a part of this collaboration with The Progressive. You know, I think a lot of this stemmed from a series that we've been able to start at Project Censored called Critical Media Literacy in Action, which is a great social media series that takes a critical media literacy lens at headlines and current media content for young people. That's where a lot of people are getting their information nowadays. We used it as a segue to write this article. I think Reagan was the mastermind behind Critical Media Literacy in Action series, if you want to talk about it a little.
Yeah, as Mickey mentioned, I'm the social media manager at Project Censored, and I really wanted, all three of us really wanted to focus our efforts on helping people be able to engage with social media and news in a more critical manner. So instead of just interacting with the news through a normal media literacy lens, interacting with it through a critical lens. So being able to decipher between good news sources and bad news sources, look beyond just what they're reporting on, like who's reporting on it, where are they getting their funding, things like that. Since we've started the series, we've worked with journalists like Alan McLeod. Kevin Gastola is going to be in an upcoming episode. We focus on framing, language, the issue of passive voice, things like that. And all of that can be found on our social media accounts.
Shaylee, let's bring you into the conversation here, too. This is an interesting approach. So it's not a protectionist approach to media literacy where we're fear-mongering or finger-wagging at the youth. Facebook is dangerous. X is dangerous. It's a cesspool for hatred. Many things can be simultaneously true. The technologies that we have are tools. They can be used for good. They can be used for not so good. But again, some of the things that you all point out in the article, while pointing out some of the downsides, some of the censorship, things like shadow banning, you all can talk a little bit more about that. You also do focus on the fact that, guess what? Particularly among young people, social media platforms are a place where people are getting news and information. I mean, that's just the reality. That's That's what's happening. Those are the behaviors. And so rather than finger wag and shame people for these practices, maybe it's a better idea to educate them about how things are happening, why they're happening, maybe clue people into some of the things that they're missing that might really matter to them so they understand that media literacy is an issue for them too. It's something for everyone. We need to be teaching everyone these kinds of skills. Shaylee.
Yeah, I mean, we use these apps every day, multiple times a day. But I think many of us don't even realize why we're seeing the content we're seeing. And that's coming from three digital natives who have used the internet like practically our whole lives. So we're sort of intuitive about it. So we feel as though we have full control over the curation of our For You page or our Discover page. And, you know, that's not necessarily the case. Social media algorithms are specifically designed to prioritize user engagement, to boost advertising revenue. And that means that extreme political content or controversial topics are more likely to be amplified. And so when we're coming upon any election, it's important that everyone participating in that system understands why they're seeing the content they're seeing on their feeds and how to make sense of all of that. And not everything on social media is inherently untrustworthy. But there's always something more to consider when you're coming across political content anywhere, but especially on these social media platforms.
I don't get to quote Ronald Reagan very often, but the trust but verify sentiment springs to mind, you know, when even he was seeing things happening in his administration that he didn't realize or want to acknowledge were true, but in fact were. Rare instance of presidential apologies around those things, but it has been 40 years. But we have our work cut out for us because we have more and more people, particularly young people, getting information from these social media platforms. They're owned by these private big tech companies for profit that also have contracts with the government for other things, other reasons. And of course, with the whole flap around fake news and during the Trump years and how that all got off leash and weaponized and mis and disinformation became a sort of a rallying cry among Democrats. Again, having these issues be turned into partisan issues is even more problematic, where one party is claiming that it has the truth on its side and everything else is fake news. I mean, we can get into some of that. Okay, what are some of the ways that that whole fake news moral panic was used to usher in these Trojan horses, as they might be called, ways to curate the information? We want to squelch disinformation. We want to prevent people from seeing bad information before it goes viral around the world. What are some ways that social media companies were surreptitiously trying to squelch these kinds of posts? I know you talk about shadow banning, and I know you talk about algo speak, you know, algorithmic speak. Kate, maybe you can talk a little bit about this.
In the era of Trump, in the era of misinformation, disinformation, it did ramp up a lot of content moderation online. There's all of a sudden an huge volume of content circulating that was spreading a lot of, you know, what was co-opted as like fake news in some ways. But this brought about this kind of push for automated content by moderation, because this is a way for social media platforms to don't have to rely on human beings. They can deal with a large amount of content relatively quickly. But this is pointing to a lot of different problems, because when you have an automated system that's owned by big private corporations, they're dictating what is deemed appropriate or not appropriate, what's allowed and not allowed online. And when we put that power in the hands of a few large private corporations, I think history has shown us that that doesn't end up very well. Not only that, but automated content moderation, these are AI, these are digital technologies that are flawed. They're made by people and they're reflecting the flaws of society at large. And they're not perfect in detecting what's appropriate, what's deemed harmful. They have a hard time understanding nuance. They're not always consistent. So when we're looking at it in the scope of an election year, that makes it very dicey for what are we seeing online. This is heavily influenced by imperfect technology.
Yeah, Reagan, you wanted to come in here? Reagan Haney?
I also just wanted to point out that it's not just AI that's monitoring the disinformation and misinformation. The Intercept came out a few years ago and reported on the DHS leaks talking about how the government has direct access to filter what they deem to be misinformation and disinformation. And we also have Alan McLeod reported on at Mint Press, the involvement, the direct involvement of former CIA and Mossad agents at big tech companies like Meta, like Google. So there's really a whole plethora of reasons why the monitoring of disinformation happens and how it happens. Our government is certainly involved in that too.
And you all write here, Shaylee Voidel, you can come in too. And but you also specifically write about something, and we've done, you know, we've covered this at the project in the past. In 2023, GLAAD, the activist group, gave TikTok, Facebook, and Instagram, YouTube, and X, formerly Twitter, low or failing scores in its social media safety index, saying that the platform's content moderation practices don't do enough to keep users safe from hate speech or harassment, particularly around LGBTQ plus users. Shaylee, jump in here and then we'll go to Kate.
Yeah, I think that this is where critical media literacy plays a very big role. These things are so important to understand how social media platforms are deliberately influencing how we interpret not only news stories, but all kinds of information that we see online. So as much as a cool resource as these apps can be for building community and learning and engaging with things that you may not have previously been exposed to, it can also fight against that in many ways and have the opposite effect. And I know Kate has something that she wanted to share as well.
Kate.
I think I was just going to elaborate on that, in that we're seeing a lot of social justice movements, political content, it's being reflected online from what we're seeing in the streets around us. And that has particular importance when it has to do with marginalized groups, LGBTQ community being one of them. There has been numerous different studies that have come out. The Conversation put out a piece when they were talking about automated content moderation disproportionately affects marginalized communities. During the Black Lives Matter movement, TikTok was flagging people for having the word Black in their bios or in their content. And the same goes for people in the LGBTQ community. This speaks to something that we talked about in the article, I think you mentioned earlier, Mickey, of shadow banning, which is this kind of covert way for social media companies to hide pretty much information. It's less of an explicit act of censorship, but it's a way for these organizations to have plausible deniability that they didn't explicitly delete, but they're still deeming this content sensitive in a way that is not explicitly content violations, but enough for them to kind of push it away. So if someone's scrolling on their For You page, you're expecting that the algorithm's going to show you people you're following, issues that you're interested in. But the reality is you're not getting the full picture painted for you from your For You page, because there are things that are not explicitly being communicated that they are censoring in a lot of different ways. And that does disproportionately affect marginalized communities and marginalized social justice issues.
So this is clearly a media literacy, a critical media literacy issue. It's clearly a teachable moment. I'd like to remind our listeners that you're tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. I'm speaking with Kate Horgan, Reagan Haney, and Shaylee Voidel, co-authors of an article, Navigating the Digital Democracy. Social media has the power to influence voters. It is part of the special media literacy issue of the summer, Progressive Magazine. We will continue our conversation with our guests after this brief musical break. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment, we are speaking with Kate Horgan, Reagan Haney, and Shaylee Voidel, who co-authored a piece for the special summer issue of the Progressive Magazine on media literacy. The article is called Navigating the Digital Democracy. We're talking about social media platforms and their use during an election year. Just before the break, we were talking about some of the challenges we face, some of the maybe invisible challenges, right? Seemingly, we were talking a little bit about shadow banning as one of the ways in which these tech companies, big tech companies, social media companies, Meta, for example, that owns Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp, how they're able to sort of throttle down things that people are posting. The interesting thing about shadow banning is that you may be posting things to social media accounts and be unaware that because of what you're posting and because of the content that you are algorithmically being disappeared or rendered more invisible, or your reach into that digital space is extraordinarily curtailed, unbeknownst to you. That's the shadow part of the banning, is that many people are unaware that this is happening. Reagan, let's go to you.
Just on the issue of algorithms and the issue of suppressing information, this issue got so much worse recently this year. Right as we were beginning to draft this piece, Meta updated its newsworthy allowance policy, which some of our listeners might remember. But this was essentially an automatic rollout of this policy where users were not notified, but Meta had automatically adjusted user settings, everybody's settings, to limit political content from accounts that you were not following. And if anyone uses Instagram or Facebook, you probably know that this affects a big percentage of the information that you're consuming. And again, the timing, it's particularly suspicious given what's going on in Gaza and the way in which young people are being radicalized through social media and through learning about what's happening on the ground in Palestine. So it seems like there's some underlying intentions and reasoning behind this policy.
We're talking about shadow banning. And so TikTok has been getting some special attention this year. It's owned by a Chinese company, ByteDance. It was part of legislation that was actually funding arms to some hotspots around the world, where it would be banned by the end of the year if it didn't divest. The specific attention to TikTok was curious because even as Mitt Romney and others said out loud, the reason they were targeting TikTok was because they couldn't curate the content about Gaza. Shaylee or Kate?
I think this is why young people are frustrated with the system. We're getting these messages and immediately contradicting these messages. Obviously, the Biden administration was all for this bill, but still continues to use TikTok to promote the campaign. So it's frustrating, I think, when you're getting that content and you feel talked down to in a lot of ways. This is your connection to, as Kate was mentioning, communities that maybe you aren't a part of in your real life, that, you know, online spaces are so sacred in that way. And so TikTok being maybe stripped away from you is frustrating because it's an issue of censorship, but it's also frustrating when leaders are like, okay, well, you know, in the meantime, we can use it to promote our messages that maybe you don't necessarily agree with anyway. So it's a tricky thing, but I think having that where we don't get that transparency from people, we're hopefully with this article trying to allow people, young people especially, the tools to be discerning consumers of that information.
There's also certain topics, and again, back to the LGBTQ plus issues. There's a couple specific things that you write about, that you all write about in the article. One is COSA, the Kids Online Safety Act. And the other, of course, we've covered the project before, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency Act, or CISA. Can any of you speak to those? Because it's another effort to seemingly keep people safe or to address safety issues that maybe ends up backfiring or has other consequences.
Shaylee also might have something to say about this, too, but COSA is the Kids Online Safety Act. And Mickey, you pretty much described it well. It was disguised as a policy or a piece of legislation that was being implemented to protect kids online and to protect them from certain kinds of information. But what that piece of legislation really did was it suppressed content related to abortion, LGBTQIA issues, mental health issues, sex education issues. So when you hear that, it's really hard to understand, what are we protecting kids from? None of this is dangerous information. So there's clearly something else going on here.
You also cite a professor at UCLA, Sarah Roberts, basically saying that this kind of automated content moderation misses nuances. And so, again, let's even pretend that there's noble intent behind protection of kids and so forth. But it's also inadvertently, I'm being pretty diplomatic there, it is having negative consequences. It is having a censorious effect. The degree to which that people have figured out online that they don't talk about sex work in the way, they don't call people sex workers, they call them accountants or something. And Kate, I know you might want to talk to this too. This algo speak or algorithm speak, a means by which people try to circumvent the automated censors or shadow bans. Kate, can you talk about that?
I think it's really reflective of also some powerful organizing that's happened by young people through online communities currently. Algo speak is really a way to circumvent, like you said, Mickey, these algorithms and words, phrases, topics that might be otherwise flagged, whether they're told explicitly that they're flagged or not explicitly. This is kind of leading back to shadow banning, where people might not know if they're getting pushed off the algorithms. So they've developed ways to communicate with each other and communicate these topics in ways that will actually reach each other. For example, in the pro-Palestine movement currently, a lot of people are using the symbol of a watermelon to discuss Palestine. That is a way for them to not have their content censored or policed. You were talking about sex work. People will call themselves accountants. The word lesbian, the dollar bean was like it had like a dollar sign in it. And these are just different like phrases, words, ways for people to get around this. But I think this is reflective too of something that's been around for years. I mean, when we look at the history of the LGBTQ movement, there was a time in history where they had to speak to each other in a way of asking, are you a friend of Dorothy? You know, you couldn't outright ask someone if they were gay. So we see this in a lot of different social justice areas where we have to work around these systems to get our messages across. It's taking a new form when it's online and when it's being controlled and co-opted by these few private large organizations.
And then, of course, another issue you bring up is, and again, I mentioned the professor from UCLA, the automated content moderation. She goes on to say that content moderation, quote, requires linguistic and cultural competencies that machines cannot achieve. That seems to be an extraordinary limitation that many of our tech overlords don't want to talk about in the open. And that's not to say that there aren't positive uses for AI, but the critical media literacy default is to be skeptical of some of these things. Shaylee Voitl.
Yes, it's deserving of our skepticism. And I think also even just going back to some of the legislation that's seeking to regulate content online, the problem with it is that it's vague and it leads to censorship of perfectly legal and constitutionally protected speech. So when you see it growing and growing, growing in terms of what we're not able to see online, perhaps in the near future, it's scary. And I think it's scary to people to whom obviously these spaces are, as I said before, very sacred and important spaces for identity, for community, for education, all very, very important things to consider. But these pieces of legislation in particular are deliberately vague, and that's a problem.
It certainly is and can be, and we need to be alert to it. Kate, Reagan, Shaylee, your final thoughts based on some of your work on this article, some final thoughts from each of you. Kate Horgan.
I think using social media as a tool is something that I think we can do more. You know, as we've said over and over again, critical media literacy is not about being critical. You can use it also to spread messages. I think Algo Speak and the things we talked about, these are great examples of ways that people are able to communicate their messages, to spread awareness about political issues, social justice issues that matter. Just as much as social media and AI is scary, don't be afraid to also use it to your advantage to interact with your community, to engage in political discourse and, you know, be civically engaged. I think it's a powerful tool.
Knowledge certainly is power, particularly the kind of knowledge that one gets from understanding critical media literacy and how these platforms actually work, for whom, which voices may be excluded, can really spur people to seek out other kinds of information. Reagan Haney, final thoughts from you in this segment.
I know things seem really bleak right now in the world and also online, and I think it's really tempting to lose hope and to give up. And, you know, there's so many barriers put into place to prevent progress and to prevent action. But I think it's really important that we all hold strong and to continue voicing our opinions and to voice our frustrations. especially online. I know that there's a lot of limitations to online activism, and there are limitations with online activism, but I also think that there's so much potential to spread messages and to gain support for issues. Like 2 years ago, no one talked about Palestine. No one cared about Palestine. And look where we are now. Even centrist people are supporters of Palestine and are frustrated, and seeing progress happen in real time for causes and issues that maybe didn't have that support earlier in time, I think is exciting. And I just hope that people continue to be active online.
Shaylee Voitel, some final thoughts.
I think both Kate and Reagan brought up amazing points about social media being very empowering. It is. It's an amazingly empowering tool that we can use to learn so much about the world around us. And then on the other side of the coin there, it's also important to have the tools, additional tools at our disposal, you know, to allow us to see some things that may not be in our best interest. And that involves learning how these algorithms work. And that is unique to each platform. They're not all the same. And knowing that you might be caught in these sort of echo chambers, and the further you get into that, the harder it can be to get out. Not only to be open to new information, but to find it on your feeds. You're just not being exposed to it. So I think just understanding how that works makes social media even more empowering. And that's what I think we would really love young people to achieve. And I think they're already doing that, which I think is very inspiring.
Your article is Navigating the Digital Democracy. Social media has the power to influence voters. This article can be found at progressive.org. It is in the special summer issue on media literacy of the Progressive magazine. Kate, Reagan, Shaylee, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Mickey.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians.
You've been listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff, the executive producer and host of the program. Anthony Fest is our longtime senior producer. To learn more about our work or find any of our previous archive programs, go to projectcensored.org. Thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
Unthinkable crimes perpetrated by criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by taxing while the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, and the ties with a master thief. Combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. If you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu.